This podcast is recorded on stolen and unceded Aboriginal land.
We acknowledge the First Nations and elders of this country, and we join their calls for justice.
Hey, comrades. It's me, Emerald. Don't know if you remember me. I used to co-host the show. You might have forgotten me because I've been gone for so long. I am in Bohol in the Philippines, enjoying a lovely post-election break, escaping that all. Apart from the fact that in the Philippines, they still have like their version of candidate call flutes up months after their presidential election. They have like, apparently some of them are home printed candidate photos on tarpaulin, which is like a thin kind of like bunting plastic material. But it's a bit of fun because the candidates all have these like variety of poses and like eagles in the background. And like one guy had, he had like a peace sign. He was grinning. The woman who I understand is now vice president and is the daughter of a former very corrupt president, has like her hand on her heart. So that's a bit of fun. But otherwise, I'm mostly switched off. I hear things are going well there, something about an energy crisis. So I don't know, good luck with that. Best of luck to you all, I guess. And I mean, we are going to find out who PR guy is. So that's interesting. I haven't seen George Christensen yet, for those who've been asking, haven't spotted him, but I have spotted many classic old white guy with beautiful young Filipino woman couples. That's cool. And just a lot of like the legacy of, you know, imperialist capitalism in the Philippines, and, you know, destructive climate change, severe weather events. So not able to entirely switch off. And I never thought I would fucking say these words, but I almost have FOMO for National Conference. And I'm sad that I won't be there to like see new friends and celebrate our fucking massive wins. But anyway, celebrate without me. I may leave a couple of other messages before I get back because I'm going to South Korea next. I'll have a few weeks before I'm back. But until then, as they say in the Philippines, ingat, that's Tagalog for take care. Sorry if I fucking butchered it for anyone who genuinely speaks Tagalog, but ingat.
Talk about the Greens. That bunch of idiots.
If you want the dole for life, free marijuana, vote Greens.
These people, these Greens, they are snake oil salesmen.
They're a bunch of breath bags and a bunch of idiots, and I've got no time for them whatsoever.
Frankly, I've always found the Greens to be a real serious danger to Australia.
Serious danger to Australia.
Thank you, dear Emerald. Miss you. Miss you very much. Welcome to Serious Danger, everybody. This is a podcast about green politics in Australia. It is not an official Greens Party podcast. We are independent. It is made possible with the help of the Green Institute and produced by Michael the Griff Griffin. I am Tom Ballard. Hello. Big shout out to our new patrons who have got on board the Serious Danger train. William, Riley, Renee, Kathy, Justin, Gabrielle, Amos, Jens, Lachlan, Anti-Paganda. Anti-Paganda is the name of someone who's signed up on Patreon. Keaton, Tyson, and Ellen. If you want to be cool like those people, you can go to patreon.com/seriousdangerau. Chip in whatever you can every month just to help this show exist. To pay the wage of our wonderful producer, Emerald, and myself are volunteers. My guest host is a volunteer. I hope he's aware of that fact. We should have talked about that before we started. But yes, we do this for the love, and we would love your help to keep it happening. So go to Serious Danger AU on Patreon. This week's special guest co-host, I'm very excited about the fact that he is here. He's a writer, climate and energy communicator, the author of Windfall, Unlocking a Fossil-Free Future, all the way live from a social democracy, Oslo in Norway, Ketan Joshi. Hello, man. How are you going?
Hi, good. I'm all suitably rubbed up. You know, it's not cold, but I felt like I should just to maintain the image. And then, but I'm also wearing a huge hat indoors. So
wearing an Australian broad-brimmed hat, which is kind of, okay, bring some Australia to Norway. That's very nice.
Yes.
People will be very familiar, I'm sure, on Twitter. You can follow Ketan at KetanJ0 on Twitter or go to ketanjoshi.co to check out his writing and his thoughts. Always very clear, always bang on, always bringing the fire. Fact-checking people left, right, and center and bringing the truth. And we hope that you can bring that to this wonderful show. Opening question, I suppose, it might be worth saying, and don't feel you have to say nice things just because you're on Serious Danger. What are your thoughts and feelings about the Australian Greens? Yes or no? Thumbs up or down?
Definitely thumbs up. I mean, I have a really climate-centric worldview. Like, it's really It's one of those things that has kind of seeped into every single type of politics in my life. And really all that, everything that I align my thinking around is just around a really straightforward metric of how good is a party at two elements of climate. One element is the physical emission side, how strong are their policies to get emissions down. And the other element is around justice and equity. So how good are their policies to ensure that climate actions don't leave anyone behind, they don't introduce new inequities or problems in their design. Are they sort of suitably representative of the community, those policies? And the Greens, of course, are when you put that first number into the emissions number, you can kind of compare each party. There was a good analysis just before the election. And of course, the Greens have the sort of highest climate target. They have the most they have policies that are most closely aligned with the IPCC. And when I say aligned, I mean, they're there. The other parties basically just don't. Some relationship. Whereas a lot of the other parties just ignore huge swathes of it or directly contradict them. which is pretty stunning. Someone might hear that and think, oh, wow, he's just such a Greens voter. And it's like, unfortunately, the reality is somewhat more dire in that you kind of have to extremely lower your standards when it comes to using climate as like a baseline.
Yes.
For politics. I guess when I was younger, there was a bunch of issues that I disagreed with the Greens about. Stuff like genetic modification of food when it comes to boundaries around that, nuclear power, that's a biggie. I think we could get into that later. But I think as I've kind of gotten older, I've become a little less interested in party policies on those things, and a little bit more interested in community positions and how people sort of pick up those issues and mix them around in their head and wrangle them. Those are things that I think really surprisingly a bit more people think about them a bit more deeply and a bit more in a much more complex way. Even though I kind of there are some positions of the Greens that I slightly disagree with, everything just gets completely overridden and bulldozed by the fact that, it's the only party that's anywhere close on climate. And of course, there's the sort of social justice / equity element, which is really, really important, I think. It's not something that you hear mentioned a huge amount. You kind of see it cropping up in little pockets in other parties' policies. Like the Labour Party has low-income homes policy as part of their electricity sector policy. But no one really makes it the core base of how they're designing policies. And that's really important to me, which we can get into that later on too. But that's kind of stems from my background working in wind power and looking at different things that many people didn't really understand to be an energy justice issue, but has really turned out to be. So particularly around conflict at the sites of development and things like that. So basically 95% a thumbs up to the Greens. But it's, it's really, part of it is a symptom of my own hyper narrow obsessions. And I'm sure if I were a much more broadly politically engaged person, I probably would have given you a slightly different answer.
You're one of those post-materialist assholes that the writer always talking about. You're the luxury shoe guy who's just obsessed with the survival of human life on this planet going into the future.
It's so elite, to want to exist within a normal atmospheric global Earth system.
Inner city Norwegian wanker. I was reading about this week again. To defend the Greens and bitch about it, the Greens' emissions reductions are in line with the Climate Council. Now, the Climate Council is what came out of the Climate Commission, which was established by the Gillard Labor government. Okay, they set up the Climate Commission to give fearless, scientific, informed advice on climate issues in Australia. Tony Abbott gets in and abolishes it because he's an asshole. Then they go on to form the Climate Council. It's same crew, okay? Same people sticking around, set up by Labor, letting you know very, very clearly these are the emission reduction targets we need to go for: 75% by 2030, net zero by 2035. Yeah. Lots of other organizations say that is entirely possible with a huge amount of investment and moving very quickly. And then the Greens say, we agree with these experts, and we're dismissed as the crazy hippies who aren't wedded in reality. So, it's like, it's infuriating.
Yeah, this is actually a really, really interesting way of putting it, because so particularly in the lead up to the previous election, I heard this language a lot, particularly from Labor, and even a little bit from the sort of like self-described moderates in the Liberal Party, about being aligned with the science. They'll say something like, we're following the science, or we're aligned with the science, or, you know, we're listening to the experts, whatever. And I always found that to be a really peculiar framing of this problem. And it stems from the fact that in the 2010s, this binary of whether or not you accept the science as real or fake, that was the primary like frame for this issue, right? It was like, are you a climate denier or are you a climate believer? And there's just so many like offshoots and symptoms and like, you know, sort of vestigial things going along, like lagging from that. Whereas in reality these days, when you have like, take the 2030 targets, for instance, right? You've got this dial that you can twist it, that it's just a number, like as a proportion of what emissions were in 2005, what percentage are you targeting, right? Like basically how much damage to us from greenhouse gas emissions are you willing to accept in the space of the next 8 years, right? That dial is being twisted not in terms of like how much you align with the science, but how much harm you want to allow to be caused to people, right? You could see a really similar thing with COVID policy, but everyone talked about it a lot more explicitly in terms of damage to people people could talk about it in terms of damage to environment as well. But that's not really aligning with the science. Like the science just describes the relationship between turning the knob and how much harm is caused, right? That's the physical sciences of climate change. What the science doesn't describe is how much should you let people be hurt by fossil fuels? There's no, like, it tells you what you need to do to reach certain goals, right? Like, if you want to keep global heating underneath 1.5 degrees, you need to do a whole bunch of things that people are just not deciding, they're just deciding not to do. So what you get is a lot of people who say like, oh, we're aligned with the science, but then you kind of prod their policies a little bit and they're like, yes, well, the science that says that if you allow a huge amount of fossil fuel burning in the next like 8 years, and then the science describes like losing the Great Barrier Reef and losing, you know, crop systems and all that sort of stuff, that's the science we're aligned with. Like, we never said which science. We never said like the science that describes what happens when you keep warming underneath 1.5 degrees. Yes. We just mean the science that says climate change happens if you turn the knob, but to a certain degree, right? This is actually really important to understand the distinction between like accepting that there's a relationship between what we do and the physical consequences to us and to Earth and to animals and plants, and then just kind of going, okay, but we're just going to let it happen.
Yeah, well.
Yeah.
We've got all the latest data. We've got people in lab coats telling us exactly how much shit our policies will inflict upon the people of Australia and the world. We're totally across that.
Exactly.
We'll put them in Excel spreadsheets and you could all enjoy those.
So when the IPCC's first report came out last year, I described it as basically this what we're in right now is like a mode of sort of like micro-denial where people go, no, I accept the science. Like, what are you talking about? You know, like the science is fine. IPCC is fine. I just think that we should just let it happen. it's terrifying. It's almost scarier than climate denial.
Yeah, Jesus. All right. We'll get into that a little bit more deeper in a bit where we talk about the climate wars, which are over now, which is fantastic. It's really good to see. Just very quickly, I want to give a plug to another podcast. Imagine that people who listen to this might be into. Flood Media is a Brisbane-based left-wing media outlet. They write great articles. They also have a podcast called Floodcast. And Max Chandler-Mather and a bunch of the folks involved in the Griffith campaign just did the latest episode. We are all in this organism together now. We'll put a link in the show notes, but I was just listening to that this week. And I reckon, again, if you want to really great insight into how they won there. They blow up all the misconceptions about why the Greens won in Griffith. I think you'll really get into that. So we'll put the link in the show notes, but check out Flood Media.
Now, we've got a crisis in energy. And what's gas got to do with this?
Well, gas is important because the job of the regulator, Brian, when demand goes through the roof, is to generate extra capacity using gas.
How do they do that?
Well, they don't, Brian. They can't. They haven't got any gas.
But we export billions of dollars of gas.
That's right. But by definition, that's exported, Brian. That's gone offshore. We need some of that gas here.
But they get a better price for exporting.
They get a better price here. It's a market, Brian. This is part of the problem.
Man, I'm so glad you're here because I cannot think of a better person to talk about the crazy shit that went down in the news this week. The eastern states of Australia are in the midst of an energy crisis. You probably heard about this. We've got the climate crisis. That's kicking along. That's going really well. We've got a cost of living crisis. Whack an energy crisis in there as well, if you don't mind. Spot gas prices surged from $10 per gigajoule a few months ago to up to $800 per gigajoule. It was a moment when there was actually a spot price of $800 per gigajoule of gas. Obviously, that's going to be, you know, affecting businesses and hitting households very, very hard. The Australian Energy Market Operator had to temporarily step in and cap prices at $40. Imagine controlling prices in a modern economy. It's ridiculous. The electricity price surge is so dire, small energy retailers like this one, Reamped, I think they're in the South Australia or the ACT, they were advising customers to switch energy providers to be hit or be hit with much higher bills. They said, look, if you stay with us, you're going to get fucking screwed, so go somewhere else, which is incredible. And there are more price rises on the way. From the 1st of July, the default market offer for energy retailers is set to increase by 14% in New South Wales, 11% in Queensland, 7% in South Australia. It's real bad news. Ketan, can you give us the basic lowdown? Why is this happening right now? What's going on?
Yeah. So it's a real trifecta. Every single fossil fuel is messing up in some way in every sector. Start with, you know, like people possibly have even forgotten about this by now, but like oil and petroleum and aviation fuel as well have been expensive before Russia decided to invade Ukraine. This has been a problem that is sort of lingering from pandemic-related supply issues, major shutdowns of terminals and maintenance problems. And as a consequence, there was a time, you know, sort of early on in the pandemic when oil prices were ridiculously low, like the lowest they've ever been, and they swung upwards very dramatically. Of course, the war in Ukraine has exacerbated that significantly. And petrol prices, of course, for Australians have been rising a lot. Gas is a really is a bit more complicated. Australia, of course, is one of the world's major sort of suppliers of methane gas, and most of the gas that it digs up, it sells overseas. The highest domestic use of gas in Australia is, in fact, the industry, the companies that dig it up and sell it overseas, because you just need so much gas just to get the other gas to the people, to the other people in other countries, which is so wild. And then, you know, there's domestic users, so people who are heating their homes and cooking their food. And then there's industrial users in Australia as well, both of which are exposed to fluctuations in international gas prices. And as a, you know, a sort of the war, but also similar sort of maintenance issues with terminals and extraction sites, other sort of constraints on supply and demand across the world have resulted in gas price also going up very, very significantly. Mm. Similar story for coal. Coal supply has been, the cost of coal around the world has been going up quite a lot. And specifically in Australia, in the power grid, a collection of coal plants are at their lowest availability, I think, pretty much ever, thanks to a few coal mines have been flooded. Of course, you know, increasing floods are one of the consequences of burning coal. Burning so much coal is that you get changes to Earth's climate system such that, you know, atmospheres retain more moisture and water content, and, you know, that water ends up in worsening floods as a consequence. So, you know, this is another climate impact that's directly impacting the grid. The other, of course, being extreme heat and fires. And so what we're seeing really is just, this is actually just another consequence of the impacts of reliance on fossil fuels impacting the reliability of fossil fuels themselves. And so those three things all in unison obviously have a very, very major impact on a country that remains very heavily reliant on fossil fuels. So in the power grid, in industry, in people's homes, and also for transport, for getting around.
Yeah.
And so it's just really a lot of things. People sort of talk about this as like a confluence or like a perfect storm. But of course, you know, it's really not like that phrase sort of invokes like a few random factors all kind of coalescing or converging at the same time in a sort of semi-coincidental way. Whereas this is really the inevitable consequence of a total reliance on a system of energy supply that is very, very sensitive and vulnerable to things like war, to things like supply chain impacts from pandemics, and of course also extremely vulnerable to the consequences of climate change, the consequences of relying on fossil fuels. So it's a perfect storm in the sense that all these things kind of have come together to produce the outcome. But the reason all these things are going to come together with increasing frequency is because this is precisely what you expect when you rely on a system that's comprised of these fuels, right? That don't have any inherent resilience, that require mining and extraction and transport of fuels around the world. This is what's going to happen more and more. We're going to have another perfect storm again in, you know, 2 years and then 1 year and then 6 months. And, you know, this is a death spiral would probably be a more apt analogy. Seriously, like it's like when I say death spiral, I mean that in the sense that like this is fossil fuels on the way out, but in an extremely disorganized and unpleasant and unfair way. People, you know, shouldn't really have to experience super high energy costs. The transition away from fossil fuels should be managed.
Yeah.
And I guess we'll get to it, but I don't think we're doing a particularly good job of listening to the signal and being like, oh, wow, okay, this is really, you know. This is when you look at this in the context of like the broader story, it means we need to really ramp up action to stop relying on fossil fuels.
Yes.
So
people can twist this shit however they like, right? So it's like, obviously, if you're a defender of fossil fuels, you say, see, this is what happens when you artificially close down the coal industry. And of course, these big companies aren't investing and maintaining their coal-fired power stations because we're all getting out of coal. So it's actually your fault and all your little hippies mates fault for not investing and giving the care and need that our fossil fuel industry needs.
Well, yeah, exactly. And it's a really good way of putting it. Have you seen that meme with like the dude with the pin board and he's got like red wire between all the little pins?
Yes.
that's me. That's me in the specific context of I've always believed that there has been a sort of quiet conspiracy to allow through omission and a lack of action, the like degradation of like infrastructure and fossil fuel assets, specifically so that things go wrong and that like they can kind of point to like all you have to do is just be a terrible, terrible leader and make shitty policy and don't then just let things naturally neglect. And then you can point to it and go, oh, no, look, things are all going wrong. You know, see how much we need to invest in more fossil fuels.
Right.
So it's not like one of those conspiracies where, like, people are sitting in a dark room and being like, ha, 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 how do we figure this out? All they have to do is just be shit at their jobs. And then they can take the consequences of them being shit at their jobs as evidence that we need more fossil fuels in the system. So
brilliant.
Yeah.
It's a good racket.
Yes.
We should say, I mean, this cold snap is also, you know, being thrown in. It's another factor. And obviously, yes, in Australia, the Southern Hemisphere, we're in winter. It's very cold. But, you know, obviously that happens every year if people get cold and they need power to heat their home. So that's a regular one.
You know, here in Oslo, our power market, you know, Oslo is 95% hydro-powered or something like that.
Oh, wow.
You know, we've got a lot of state-owned power generation here, and it doesn't matter. You know, the price I pay on my power bill is still increasing quite significantly, despite the fact that we're in summer with significantly lower energy demand. And no heating requirements, it's still gas power that's, you know, setting the price in other countries, and Norway's on like a, you know, the European market. So that's it. That's the story. You know, gas kind of just ends up still making things really, really expensive. It's awful.
You mentioned just how cooked Australia's gas market is and the situation he is in, and it is, and people might be across that in 2017, this sort of hit the headlines as well. We really started thinking about how insane this country is when it comes to extracting gas and selling it in the world. I mean, there is no real gas shortage now in Australia. We produce way more gas than we consume every year. We shouldn't have supply issues when these big international shocks come through, you would think. You would think that Australia has plenty of gas to deal with anything, really. But what is sort of happening is the wonders of the resource market forces is why things are so messed up. So as you said, Australia exports about 82% of our gas. It mainly goes to China, Japan, and South Korea. It's obviously billions and billions of dollars, extremely lucrative, and it's been seriously ramping up. Between 2000 and 2015, Australia's gas exports tripled. Then between 2015 and 2019, they tripled again. So we love gas, and it's all about the gas right now. Most of that gas is sold via long-term contracts at a fixed price, but there is like more than a third of it that's sold in a flexible way through these spot prices, and that's where you get the kind of crazy price volatility when you have something like, you know, the situation in Ukraine and lots of countries saying we don't want to buy Russian gas anymore. That's when the crazy prices can happen, and that's when these companies can make insane windfall profits. Just for a reference, in the year 2000, a single cargo of LNG was selling for up to $3 million US. Right now, Asian buyers are paying up to $150 million for a single cargo for that same amount. That's how crazy it's getting.
Holy moly. Yeah, and they're making a lot of money, you know. Like, this is really this is such a fine, this is such a really, like, you can see fossil fuel lobby groups and oil and gas companies doing a super tenuous, dangerous dance here, because they want to use this crisis as an opportunity to call for more investment in long-term fossil fuel infrastructure, right? The stuff that if you build it, will blast past our climate targets, right? Like, they're basically working on the assumption that we're going to fail very badly at our climate targets when they propose these new pieces of fossil fuel infrastructure. So they'll say, like, because of this crisis, we need to build a new gas terminal, or we need to do more, we need to increase extraction of fossil fuels, or get rid of environmental regulations around gas extraction, that sort of stuff. You've seen it all this week in Australia.
Yeah.
But they also don't want their dreams to come true, right? Like, they don't want an increase in the supply of oil or gas, because then these amazing prices would actually start to be depressed somewhat, right? Like, you would actually see a reduction in the obscene profits that they're having, right? Like, by having an increase of supply. So
these energy companies don't want to provide cheap power. That's against their DNA. No, of course not. They want to make as much money as possible. What are you talking about?
And so, like, basically what they want is to lock in some subsidies, some government support and subsidies.
Right, of course.
For infrastructure that will help ease the operational costs but not increase the supply of fossil fuels too much, right? So the ideal thing is, like, pay for my CCS thing, or pay for my that's carbon capture and storage, pay for my export terminal, or pay for my new ship that does whatever. But they don't want to unlock too much new extraction, because they're like suddenly like, oh, crap, okay, we better pause all of our really aggressive extraction, aggressive expansion for oil and gas extraction, because we want to maintain these prices for as long as we can. And once they inevitably drop, then they'll go back to being like, oh, can you also please subsidize our exploration for new gas fields and new oil fields? So it'll happen, I guarantee it. We've been watching them do this really sort of like careful dance for a while, where they have to keep saying wildly contradictory things to maintain their levels of obscene profits.
Brilliant. I mean, there was this insane situation back in 2017 when it was cheaper to buy Australian gas offshore, bring it back to Australia, reconvert it from liquid to gas, and then buy it on the local market, right? It was just fucking bananas. The big LNG companies we're talking about here are Chevron, Shell, Woodside, Origin, and Santos. They're all massive polluters, of course, who love to not pay tax and make big fat political donations. These are some of the companies that pay more in political donations than they do in company tax every year. And hey, what do you know? Woodside Energy, last financial year, donated $124,000 to the coalition and $108,000 to Labor. So if you're going lesser two evils, I guess they're, you know, what is that? That is $16,000 less evil than the coalition on that particular front. But there you go. So no good. But what is interesting is that this is not a national crisis because different states have taken different approaches to gas. In Western Australia, which has a gas reservation policy in which 15% of new gas that's extracted in the state needs to be reserved for the domestic market, these prices aren't skyrocketing at all. In July of last year, when the spot price per gigajoule was about $40 in the eastern states, in Western Australia, it was $5. So very interesting. I was reading a little bit about this. You know, this goes back to 2006 when ExxonMobil came into the state and said, we want to do this big Gorgon gas project. You know, let us do that, please. Said, yeah, I'm sure give us heaps of subsidies and let us do that. And the Labor government at the time said, well, you can do that, but yeah, 15% needs to be kept for domestic consumption. Exxon said, that's an outrage. Absolutely not. There's no way we're going to do that. Labor government did not back down, and eventually ExxonMobil came back and came to the table and apparently agreed to that in order to get that project up. So does that show for as long as we are extracting gas and we need to stop doing that really quick because the earth is on fire, are these kind of policies, this reservation policy, they're the ones that actually make sense and they're the ones that are the way to go, do you think?
Yeah, so I think so. I think any way to protect people from these sort of crippling prices is a good thing. I think that if that involves reserving some amount, it's actually really fascinating, of course, to see how aggressively that's opposed by fossil fuel companies, which is a nice little reckoner for whether or not policy is good or bad. So just going by that alone, it's not a bad thing to do. I think people really suffer, particularly people more vulnerable to necessary things like energy and electricity. So I think that's a really good thing to do in the very, very short term. Unfortunately, what we see happening is that when this actually gets proposed, fossil fuel companies get very nervous about it. They get really sort of they'll do like probably what you're seeing at the moment in federal politics in Australia is a lot of like background lobbying, a lot of quiet lobbying from fossil fuel companies to stop anything like that happening in Australia, which is so wild because it wouldn't even be a particularly large proportion of what they're digging up and selling overseas. But, by default, they're extremely protectionist and they don't want anything like that to happen. And of course, as you said, they want to sell it for the highest cost possible. They don't like the idea of a whole bunch of it being reserved that they'd get less money for.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that it's not a bad thing to do.
Meanwhile, in the Australian Capital Territory, where people live under the tyranny of a Labor Greens coalition government, electricity users are going to see their average electricity costs fall by at least 1.25% come the 1st of July. Now, a lot of celebration and talk about the ACT. The ACT has fixed price contracts to source an equivalent of 100% renewable energy, okay, for its electricity. Are you able to explain what that really means? Because I was, you look into this a little bit further, you go, hang on, people in the ACT are still definitely getting power from fossil fuel based sources, but
yeah, they are.
I suppose the deal they have means that the equivalent energy that they use, they offset or they buy equivalent renewable elsewhere. How does all that work?
So basically, the energy market is considered to be a pool. Think of it almost literally as a pool, like a swimming pool. At one end, you have everyone pouring their buckets of whatever into it. It all just gets sort of homogenized and mixed as like a single product. And then people at the other end are taking buckets out of everything that's being poured into the pool, So 60-70% fossil fuels, 20-30% renewables, depending on, a bunch of different variables. And of course, that proportion is changing as we build more renewables and more fossil fuels shut down. But what you can do is with your bucket standing at one end of the pool, say to someone else on the other end, okay, well, if you pour one bucket of renewables in, I'll take one bucket out of the pool.
Right.
And so what you're getting is still just the same water as everyone else. But you are acting to incentivize or encourage more people to be putting more renewables into the system. And so people gripe with the way it's described in different ways, some of which I think are probably reasonable gripes. So, you're not getting 100% renewable power supply in the same way you would be if you had like a solar panel and a battery system and you were off-grid. But that situation is ridiculous and inaccessible for the vast majority of people anyway, right? Like it's just no one's, like almost nobody has access to that type of system, where it's just pure renewable supply. I think that it's actually relatively reasonable to say, well, I entered a contract into someone who's putting stuff into this pool, and it's a relationship between me and the provider of the person who's pouring their bucket of clean, you know, renewables into the pool. And so, therefore, I can be said to have been supplying my electricity from that particular source. I think as long as there's a clarity and a clear understanding of that sort of middle factor of it's all being smooshed into this one homogenous thing, then I think it's actually okay. And of course, the sort of financial consequence is that, you know, people in the ACT are paying very significantly lower bills for basically contracting with or incentivizing an equivalent 100% renewable source for their electricity supply in ACT. One thing that really sticks in my memory is, of course, Angus Taylor, our friend Angus Taylor, basically saying that the ACT would be suffering, you know, something of an apocalypse thanks to setting this target. You know, when the target was announced, he was just like, it's going to go so bad. And now, of course, the situation is the precise inverse in that the states that are the most reliant on coal and gas are the ones suffering the worst consequences of this crisis.
Yeah.
And it's just like a, you know, straight linear relationship. Like the more you have physically built clean renewables or entered into contracts to have financial arrangements with renewables, the less exposed you are to this crisis.
Right.
Yeah.
And it makes sense for the ACT, right? The ACT is very small and it doesn't, I have no idea how many power plants it has or access to, but obviously, you know, a huge amount of power is going to be coming from outside the ACT itself. Mm-hmm. Now, South Australia is interesting because their target is to reach net 100% renewables by the 2030s, but they are planning to generate renewable electricity locally, right, equivalent to 100% of its annual demand. So in South Australia, you're actually going to be getting that energy, renewable energy produced within the state as well to sort of help them reach that, and invest in that to build up that sort of capacity too. So that is going. But as you say, this story is renewable energy is cheaper. And as you say, the states that are most exposed to fossil fuels are the ones that are getting fucked over big time.
One thing worth noting is that this crisis would be significantly worse were it not for the renewables that have already been built.
Right.
So what they do is the presence of renewables have this thing effect. There's this thing called a merit order effect, which is that basically when you shove a bunch of cheap supply, the way the bidding system works for the electricity market is that you basically end up with a cheaper price than you otherwise would have. It's just that the sort of, because there's only a small, relatively small proportion of renewables, that effect is like that much. And I'm just sort of, you know, doing like a small, small sort of amount with my hand here. And then like the effect in the other direction of super expensive coal and gas just completely obliterates it, right? So it would be worse. But of course, the reason that the net impact that you're seeing is rising electricity prices is just because it's really, really hard to counter the sheer impact of expensive coal and gas.
Mm.
Yeah.
I will say, though, this is my major bugbear. Things are still not perfect in the ACT. I was saying there was a statement released from the regulator or whatever saying consumers are still encouraged to regularly compare energy tariffs to other offers that are in the market. And I just, the privatization of our electricity provision drives me fucking mental. I don't care. I just want energy and I don't want to spend my life comparing the offers from various energy companies to find out which one is ripping me off less. Can't we just get energy provided to me cheaply? There's no variety of energy. It's all the same shit. Just give it to my house and let me pay the smallest amount of money that I possibly can in order to do that.
I mean, like, can you imagine shopping around for different water providers? You know, like, make sure you shop, compare different water, you know, like companies to
God, you would rightly
go mad. Yeah. And it should be the same for electricity. Like, this is, of course, part of the system of, maybe it's too strong a word, but it's oppressive. Maybe it's not a system of oppression, but it is certainly an oppressive thing to put the burden on people to sit there and wrangle that volume of information and be like, okay, well, you know, cents per kilowatt hour and grid costs and blah, blah. Like, no one has time for that. We're all exhausted. No. Like, we're so tired. and to say to people that, oh, no, it's your responsibility to shop around for something cheaper. That bugs me too. I find that really frustrating. Yeah.
It's so much more efficient though. It's really efficient to have entire government agencies that are just set up to monitor these agencies, make sure they're not ripping people off. That's a really good system too, rather than just having a publicly owned electricity grid in which energy is provided because it's a basic service to live in the 21st century, for fuck's sake. Anyway. Yes. That's why. Yeah. That is Green's policy too, a publicly owned energy grid. So let's have that, please. Very quickly, I want to move on to some other stuff, but like what can actually be done in the short term and the long term? There was this crisis meeting this week in which the federal government got together all the heads of state and they'd agreed to design a capacity mechanism to pay providers for guaranteeing power supplies that could be called upon when needed. So I guess we're paying these companies more money to do their fucking jobs and provide us with energy that they're supposed to do. What do you think of that solution?
That is a great way of putting it. I mean, like, it's just bonkers that we, like, you know, like, we'll incentivize you to do the basic freaking thing that, like, the reason this is so frustrating to me personally that I find really, I'm not going to get into it because it's just too, I'll just rant, you know, until very into the wee hours of the Oslo morning here. But, like, this has been the primary way of talking about the transition. So not this crisis, but climate action and climate solutions in the energy transition is that fossil fuels are cheap and reliable and that renewables are expensive and unreliable, right? Like this is, you would have heard that narrative a trillion times over the past 10 years. And the reality is the precise opposite, right? Like the reason that energy is expensive and unreliable, unreliable in the sense that the provision of fuel to power stations is not really happening the way that it should be, it's because fossil fuels are inherently so, right? Like they're extremely vulnerable to these shocks. They're extremely vulnerable to like geopolitical shifts, and they're extremely vulnerable to the consequences of the thing that they cause, which is climate change. Mm. To then say, oh, no, we need a capacity mechanism to get people to provide capacity into the grid, that could potentially work to accelerate the energy transition if it becomes a tool for incentivizing integration of renewables, right? So battery storage, new transmission capacity, new things like that. But the problem, of course, is that the whole process of integrating large volumes of renewables into a grid isn't just a capacity problem, right? Like it's actually a challenge that involves stuff like having flexible ways of adjusting demand, incentivizing cheap ways to integrate renewables like, you know, community batteries, for instance, or transmission lines that are sort of reasonably developed and cheaply developed with like communities in mind and things like that. None of that is helped along by a capacity mechanism. What could potentially be helped along is coal plants and gas plants who are desperate for a lifeline and desperate for government support because they see the headwinds of the energy transition coming at them despite other things like COVID and war. They're like, oh, crap, we really need to start locking in support now. And what I'm so sure is going to happen, I'm locking this in as my prediction, is that the Labour Party will basically end up in a position where they're like, no, we're technology neutral. You know, we're not going to pick winners. We're just going to like introduce this mechanism and, you know, we're not going to say like, oh, no, coal and gas can't take part in it. They'll kind of frame it as being very reasonable and very like, you know, centered and, you know, very adult and grown up. And of course, what will end up happening is that these will then become incentives for coal and gas power stations to linger past closure dates, right? Like to basically stay open for longer. And with the case of gas, potentially even incentivize the construction of new methane burning power plants. So I'm so worried about that. And then the other part of the question about like what can actually be done, what should be done. We've seen a few good examples of it across the world. So demand reduction is something that you can do straight away, right? Like you can basically erode demand for energy in general and fossil fuels specifically very, very quickly. Stuff like basically giving people alternatives to relying on fossil fuels for transport. So getting more buses, getting more trains, getting public transport much more accessible to people. Electrifying transport is a very slow process. So you can't sort of see that as a necessarily good thing, like a very quick thing to do. But building renewables is very, very fast. You can incentivize the construction of renewables very significantly I've always said Labor needs to implement a new renewable energy target. You know, they kind of had a really good one in their sort of 2010s. And then they kind of were just like, well, that's done now. You know, renewables are cheap. We don't need to do anything anymore. But that's kind of like free market thinking. You know, like even if renewables are cheap, it's still not happening fast enough. You know, so you need to actually have a system of incentivization, not just to get, you know, renewables cheap, which has already happened, but also to get them being built at a rate that is aligned with climate targets, but also is aligned with getting people significantly less exposed to the serious harms of relying on fossil fuels in the immediate sense.
What are they saying? It's like 82% penetration of renewables by 2030. Is that what they're predicting?
Well, the target's 82% by 2030, which there's a bit of debate in the electricity energy industry about whether that's just kind of what's going to happen by default.
What's going to happen anyway?
That's like the natural state of affairs without any new policy.
Yes,
or whether it's it's a bit like. It sort of doesn't matter all that much. Like, I think Labor actually, one of the things that they do well on climate is specifically wrangling the question of transmission lines. And so that will actually enable a fair amount of additional renewable energy. I think that's a pretty good policy. Mm. But I do also think that it just all needs to be quicker. I think they need to have targets that are basically there as benchmarks for their own performance. Understanding that, of course, you know, they also need to be shutting down coal plants very significantly quicker. And then the other thing that's worth noting is basically having programs to get people off gas in homes. That's something the technology is already there. It's really just a question of access and money, particularly people who are like renters. There are a lot of policies that you can introduce in the very, very short term, you know, like today, like this week's type thing, that would basically disincentivize gas being used in homes. And, you know, you can do things like subsidizing induction stoves and subsidizing other technologies that help people not use gas. And of course, you would want to target those towards the people who are most vulnerable, most exposed to rising fossil fuel prices. And so we've seen a lot of these things crop up in Europe. I think that what's happening in Australia is those things are sort of being mentioned a few times, like here and there, but they're not really like the centerpiece of the Labor Party's response. They don't really seem all that interested in significantly reducing demand for fossil fuels. They seem a bit more interested in increasing supply of fossil fuels as a way of dealing with the crisis, which is really, you know, when you talk about being aligned with the science, you know, like really, if you look at the science of 1.5C, keeping temperatures below 1.5 degrees of warming relative to pre-industrial levels, you just can't build any new fossil fuel infrastructure and you can't have any new supply of fossil fuels. Otherwise, if you do, the infrastructure will be used and the fossil fuels will be burnt and will blow past those carbon budgets. And so that is not central to their thinking, right? And the other thing is like, they're not really sort of being held to task for failing to introduce new policies to accelerate climate action and to accelerate basically getting away from reliance on fossil fuels. Mm. And they would probably respond with something like, well, that's kind of a long-term issue, you know, like that's down the line. And it relates to what I said to before about like, oh, no, it's a perfect storm. You know, it's everything just kind of coming together and we're going to deal with this one crisis. And once that's dealt with, we'll be fine. There will be another crisis, you know, in another year, another few months. And there'll be another crisis after that. And they will increase in frequency because it's a consequence of the system that we're using, not just bad luck. You know, it's not like, oh, a pandemic happened. Well, once the pandemic's, you know, done, we'll be fine. There will be other things. And so the reason that you need to start investing in, you know, significantly greater volumes of clean energy, significant energy efficiency and demand reduction programs, and really, really significant new clean infrastructure is because you have to think about the next crisis while you think about this current crisis. And so it's really frustrating to see all those opportunities and options being ignored in favor of like, oh, no, we're look how good we are, like getting on the phone to all the gas companies to get them to give us a little pittance of extra fossil fuels. Like, that's not leadership. Yes. That's not doing the right thing. You know, that, like you're just basically making the next crisis worse. And so, it was such a frustrating spectacle to listen to interviews where they're like, you know, like, the opposition is like, why aren't you on the phone to the fossil fuel companies? And Labor's like, we are on the phone to fossil fuel companies. It's like, I think everyone's missing the biggest story and the core point here. And a lot of people are going to suffer because of it. Yeah, it frustrates me and makes me very mad.
Well, that leads very nicely to the other thing I want to ask you about, which, of course, is the end of the climate wars, in which it's all over, as you know, it's all been sorted out. I mean, you know, again, just to underline, there was a story this week. Of course, the climate crisis is carrying on. Emissions are not going down across the globe. They continue to rise despite nations committing to cut them. There are a bunch of good stories that you can find in some countries doing some cool stuff, but it's all eclipsed by other nations continuing to pollute the world and cook the planet. Scientists are warning of increased climate change events, including heat waves, flooding and droughts. Classic. We crossed 420 parts per million of carbon in the Earth's atmosphere earlier this year. Before the Industrial Revolution, you had about 280 parts per million. Scientists say a safe level of carbon in the atmosphere, about 350. So that's going very badly.
Mm-hmm.
But thankfully in Australia, we've been told that's okay because now that the Albanese Labor government is elected, the climate wars are officially over. They said we can end the climate wars during the election. And literally once they've been elected, they said, oh, the climate wars are now over. It's like it's done.
Yeah.
You wrote a piece for Renew Economy, Katana, called "The Real Climate Wars Are Really Only Just Getting Started." Why aren't you convinced that we are now living in a time of climate peace?
Yeah, big climate peace. Because when people talk about the climate wars, I feel like what they're referring to was this period in sort of 2010s, early 2010s, where first you had a Labor government in power and there was a lot of fighting and debate about the Labor Party's climate policies, some of which were pretty good, some of which were sort of okay-ish, but, you know, it was something was being done. You know, like there was something there. It was really prominent and really like central to media debate and discourse about energy and climate. And then once the Labor Party lost power, it was still there, you know, like the debates were still there because the coalition government set about trying to destroy a lot of those policies. And it was like a long drawn out fight for a lot of them. And a lot of them were saved, you know, thanks to actions from like the Greens and the Labor Party and a bunch of senators. And then ongoing from that, you know, there was like this backlash to the backlash where Tony Abbott suddenly became extremely unpopular, Malcolm Turnbull gained power. And, you know, he tried doing something on climate too. And even the sort of obscenely small amount that he like wanted to do was seen as too much. And so he was sort of ousted from leadership. And then Scott Morrison was just like entered as this kind of blank slate, nothing, this like gray smudge on climate, who basically said, like, I described it back then as, you know, inaction through distraction, right? Like he kind of like his primary goal was like basically, how do I protect the fossil fuel industry by distracting people away from the problem, by trying not to think about it, trying not to make it prominent, saying that we're doing the right thing but not really doing it, also known as greenwashing.
Yeah.
And so for a long time,
terrifying people about the consequences of any real climate action that say the Labor Party or the Greens might propose, and to try and amp up the fear of killing the weekend, etc.
Yeah. Well, you know, at the most recent election, they took a very different approach where they were like, both major parties were like, we actually don't want to talk about it. You know, we want to talk about it as little as possible.
Yep.
And so the level of the heat in the debate changed, but in a bad way. Like the reason people started, like there was more agreement between the two major parties on this is because basically they agreed to not do a lot on it. And so if your framing is like, well, are people fighting or are they not fighting? Sometimes you can be in a situation where people are not fighting because they're agreeing to do the wrong thing. And so it's not a particularly good formulation for understanding why emissions are rising or not rising. And of course, the reality is that the fossil fuel industry is primarily responsible for greenhouse gas emissions in Australia. It's a corporate problem. You know, I've done some work in the past for this organization called the Australasian Centre for Corporate Responsibility. And in doing that work, I've really done some super deep dives into corporate climate action. I'm on parental leave at the moment, but, you know, my sort of day job right now is for a European sort of climate communications NGO who I'm focusing on corporate net zero targets. And so, you know, I'm basically watching what's happening in the corporate world, including in Australia. And what they're doing is saying, look, you know, we're committed to climate action. We're interested in doing the right thing. And then they kind of just continue doing the wrong thing. And they're very, very, very good at it, right? Like, this is why I focus so much on greenwashing when it came to the previous coalition government, because they were actually taking the cues from the sector, right? So they were basically twisting the numbers to make it look like they're doing the right thing. That's why, you know, you saw all those ads during the election of like, we've reduced emissions by 20% and we're investing in clean energy and blah, 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 blah. Like, they weren't saying stuff like, they weren't doing these ads being like, Labour's climate target is going to destroy the world sort of thing, like they did, you know, with the previous election.
Right.
They were really following the corporate mode of like pretending to do the right thing. And so, you know, it's not even really a war. It's sort of like this horrible cloud of like disinformation and distraction where no one's really fighting, you know, like there's no argy-bargy public fight about this sort of stuff, right? Like, look at the energy crisis in Australia. Like, is there a fight about whether or not the crisis should be a call to a very rapid and significant acceleration in emissions reductions? Not between the two major parties. There's no climate war there. Like, you know, they're in total agreement. They're like I said, you know, one side is demanding that they call the gas companies and the other side is like pleading, you know, like, look, we did call them. Like, we're asking fossil fuel companies what to do about this fossil fuel crisis. And then they're telling us and then we're listening to it. Like, isn't that great? So there is, you know, an actual climate war, of course, is that citizens are exposed to the consequences of climate change, but have very little power and influence to be able to change the systems that cause it. Of course, that's just because society is structured in a way where people don't have as much access to power as they should. It's more like the fossil fuel industry has a corrupt level of access to power. They were literally writing policies for the previous government and policies which the new government says that they're going to keep, you know, like carbon credits for having carbon capture systems on gas extraction sites. And so that's a really terrible thing. And when it comes to, you know, climate wars, I think we should reframe it and rethink it. You know, it's not about whether or not people are fighting about climate policy. It's about the raw physical reality of emissions and also about who it is that gets to decide whether emissions are rising or falling.
Right. I mean, it's so infuriating, the idea that, as you say in your piece, you know, this idea that the problem is people are disagreeing and people are yelling at each other and people can't agree on this fundamental, seismic, society-changing issue. Well, surprise, surprise, it's a class war, right? These are financial interests that are invested in the status quo, in continuing fossil fuels as long as possible, and they do not give a fuck about the things that they should give a fuck about, which is the continuing survival of the species and limiting warming, because that will, you know, incur on their profits. And the idea that the Labour Party can seriously believe, and whether they believe this or not is very much up for debate. I'm sure it's just like an election tactic and a line that they adopted that they felt like they could thread the needle on this.
Yeah.
But it's like, if you seriously believe that you can do something about this, if you can transition our entire economy and fundamentally disrupt the way that things have always been and take on these massive fossil fuel interests, which have extraordinary wealth and power in our society, and there's not going to be some fights, there's not going to be some battles or some warring around that, then you're fucking kidding yourself. Yeah. And again, I got to give it up for the Greens. It's like the Greens are just, they're saying it very clearly. You cannot, as you said, you cannot fund more fossil fuel projects if you are serious about addressing the climate crisis. And I know that they will make billions of dollars for private companies and a little bit in taxes, kind of maybe, and that your donors are giving you money to encourage you to back in these new projects. But you can't do that. You scientifically can't do it. You know, the laws of physics don't give a fuck about, the laws of physics don't know what Barnaby Joyce is.
Yeah.
They don't know like the intricacies of Australian politics. They're not following Auspol on Twitter.
Yeah.
They just are what they are. And if we're going to respect them and pursue them to make sure the earth doesn't explode, then there are certain things that we have to do. And you've got to be up to that fight. You can't just say the war's over, everyone, and then carry on as normal. That's insane.
It's very frustrating.
And then, even by that same definition, if the definition of the climate wars is like, oh, the major parties will agree on shit, that isn't happening either. Like, immediately, the coalition, now in opposition, have just pivoted to pretty much still denying climate change. Holly Hughes is the, what is she, the assistant spokesperson for climate change. She went straight into the media within 24 hours of getting that portfolio and described climate action as a luxury issue and thinks that once the cost of living crisis will kick in, people will start to see, you know, focus on that and put things in perspective.
Do you take any message at all from voters regarding climate change?
I think climate change was something that a lot of voters were focused on. But I think what's going to happen as you move forward and people start to get inflationary pressures, start to see their mortgage rates increase. And when you look at increased power prices, some of those issues that were looked at as sort of their, you know, they're almost like a luxury issue.
Did you see Holly Hughes' comments? Are you a fan?
Yeah, I did actually. Yeah, I did. And you know, just very, very like, boring old stuff, you know, really
it's classic,
stale, very, very worn, like leathery old crap, you know, like it's just so, it's like you don't even, it feels silly to even refute it now because I think even people have moved past it a fair bit. All it does is really just like make media discourse go around in circles, right? Because people take it seriously, they give it time and air. And, you know, it's something, of course, you shouldn't be taking it seriously because it's just like mouth words, you know, there's no meaning or relevance behind them. Like,
you can still wheel out these same talking points, right?
And I
am begging any journalist interviewing one of these losers to say, when they say we can't shut down the whole industry tomorrow or we can't shut it down overnight, and this is something that Holly Hughes said.
We could shut everything down tomorrow and all go live in trees.
Was the direct quote. I'm begging someone to say, okay, what if not tomorrow but like 10 years? Or, you know, what if you actually had a timeline that's a long time, like other countries have done, to actually phase this out? Like, so what? There is a difference between tomorrow overnight and in 10 years' time, right? But that would require central planning.
I call this the overnight principle. Which is basically whenever you hear somebody saying we can't shut down fossil fuels overnight, what you should really hear them saying and what I think that they're trying to say is that we should shut down fossil fuels as slow as we possibly can.
As slow
that
as
they
we,
should,
yes.
We shouldn't treat it with urgency. It's like that's what they want to say, but they have to create this ridiculous like straw man of like, no, some person who I won't name is saying that we should literally within the space of the next 24 hours just fundamentally redesigned human society. And no, we shouldn't do that. Like, you know, of course. But it's so ridiculous and bad faith that like that we should basically treat it with contempt when somebody says that. I really think we should be like non-forgiving about it because it's a ridiculous thing to say. And people are basically masking their real point and people should just be held to task for it because it's so annoying now. And I'm like, no, stop letting people say stupid stuff like that. You know, like let's just be like, no, you actually mean something else and I'm going to get it out of you. That would be cool if people did that.
Yeah. Or sometimes I'll say it explicitly. The position of the Labor government is that, you know, coal will end when the market doesn't want to buy it anymore. We should keep digging up and exporting our coal as long as people are going to buy it. And this is just deferring, again, the survival of the species to the whims of the market.
Which is cool because the atmosphere understands that. They're like, the atmosphere is like, okay, well, the market kind of like, you know, we're just going to not warm the planet. Because the market kind of needed fossil fuels.
The market will decide.
That's the climate change just won't happen for that stuff. Yeah.
We can go to another planet. We can choose. There's a free market of planets out there that we can go try as many ones.
Now do classical gas.
All right, look, this has been so interesting and great, and we're fast running out of time, and I'm conscious of that. But I did just one last question that I'll put to you.
Yep.
relates to nuclear power. Okay, so obviously Peter Dutton, the coalition, the leader of the Nationals, Ted O'Brien, this new spokesperson for climate and energy for the coalition, he is a big nuclear dude. He was part of an inquiry by the Senate looking into whether Australia should go forward with nuclear power. And, you know, he says, if we're serious about reducing greenhouse gas emissions, we simply can't ignore this zero emissions baseload technology. They're talking about these small little modular reactors that apparently are going to fix all our problems. You mentioned nuclear power is something that you potentially disagreed with in regards to Greens policy before. What are your thoughts on this? Are they right onto something where they say that nuclear power is part of the solution for Australia becoming carbon neutral?
Well, look, you've got to split it into two categories, right? Like, there's a bunch of nuclear power stations that already exist, and they are producing electricity at a lower carbon intensity than coal and gas, right? Like, that's I think that's relatively most people agree on that.
Yep.
And there's also a rising problem of nuclear power plants, actually very similar to a lot of the coal plants that we're seeing in Australia, suffering increasingly extreme reliability problems, right? So France, which is often sort of touted as like the sort of flagship of nuclear power development, has been having like year-on-year reductions in nuclear power output that are quite significant, right? Like, these percentage decreases are really significant. As a consequence, gas-fired power stations in France are increasing their output, and they're really just not building renewables at a rate that is going to sort of fill the gaps that are left by not necessarily closing nuclear power stations, but nuclear power stations with just decreasing output over the years. What we're also starting to see is that in other parts of the world, this is becoming a common phenomenon, right? So in other parts of Europe and North America, nuclear power plants are just getting old, and they're really, you know, suffering from increasing maintenance costs. And so people are basically grappling with the challenge of like, well, in a lot of these countries, renewables, wind and solar development has been pretty poor. And if we let these nuclear power plants close down, the gap may be filled by coal or gas. And so they have to make a decision about like, oh, crap. Okay. Well, now do we accelerate renewables? Do we like pay money to keep these nuclear power plants open longer? What do we do? And a lot of people are just botching that responsibility and not really making a decision at all. And the nuclear power plants reduce output or they close and it gets replaced by coal or gas. I don't think that's a good outcome at all, right? There is probably some instances in which you need to, you know, unfortunately, you need to pay money to keep them open a bit longer. There's a lot of like embedded emissions in nuclear power, right? Like, there's a lot of emissions, you know, associated with their construction, which means you need to basically sweat them for a bit longer to get their emissions reductions potential to use that up. And of course, you know, there are no take backsies with coal or gas, right? Like, once you let them fill that gap, they're actually significantly very, very difficult to get rid of. Coal and gas have incredible power of incumbency. However, that is a completely separate question to Australia, which is nuclear power is illegal to build in Australia. And it's also, there's no existing, of course, nuclear power plants in Australia either. And so it's a completely different question because you're looking at design from scratch. When you look at design from scratch, nuclear power just doesn't make sense, right? Like, to some limited degree, it could make sense in some countries if you struggle with space and land. Obviously, you know, wind and solar have their own land requirements. Solar is significantly less so because you can put it on top of buildings and homes. But wind, of course, that's like the one thing with wind, you know, that really is like, I think a legitimate criticism is that, you know, you require physical space to construct it. Obviously, offshore wind is a bit different because, you know, surface of the ocean, that sort of underneath surface of the ocean is teeming with, you know, biodiversity and wildlife. On the sort of water layer, you've got bird life, which uses ocean roots, but it's sort of a different challenge. Mm. But when it just comes down to it, like the math, when it comes down to land and biodiversity protection and renewable development, that really it makes a lot more sense to do a combination of demand reductions in Australia and the growth of large and small scale renewables. And so, of course, the way that you can tell, like, that math is not being done when it comes to the conversation that the coalition government is having on nuclear power, right? Like, they're not really going, you know, I think that the challenge of integrating renewables is very large, so we're going to look at all these options like nuclear power. They don't give a shit about any of that stuff, right? If they did, they would have talked about it when they had spent 9 years in government, right? Like, they would have actually made it a central pillar of their policy. They would have actually done something more than having like a bunch of inquiries about nuclear power. What's really happening here is that they see it as an opportunity to basically troll lefties and greenies. Like, they're kind of like, they know, like, they're like, oh, cool, you know, we let's just get people arguing about this instead of debating, you know, actually like reasonable and interesting debates about the growth of renewables and ownership of energy and who benefits and who doesn't from new energy types. All of those are actually interesting and healthy debates that Australia should be having. The coalition would much prefer that, like, you mention nuclear power in any platform, in any context, and about four or five identical discussions will happen, right? Like literally, like, they're just so predictable. I think, in my opinion, often those discussions themselves miss the big points about nuclear power, which is really, again, you could probably tell this is my thing, but like, it's a corporate question, right? Like, this is actually a question of like corporations that own and operate nuclear power and the type of decisions they're making. And, you know, the nuclear power industry just really, unfortunately, just doesn't really feature strongly in these debates. It's so weird, because they're making a bunch of really awful decisions, and, you know, you get people, you know, like, just, they just go wild on one of these and I'm talking about, like, oh, the greenies, like, Australia would be like a nuclear utopia, you know, were it not for the Greens, you know, opposing nuclear power. But when you look at the deployment, when you look at the deployment of nuclear power across the world, you know, nuclear power does not end up dominating electricity grids as the norm, right? It sort of gets a fraction, right? Like, you know, 10 to 20%. It's a lot like hydro in that sense. It has its own natural limitations when it comes to size and scale and penetration on grids. Whereas wind and solar have the potential to be workhorses, you know, they have the potential to be backbones, right? Like 70, 80% type stuff in grids if they're deployed in a sort of smart way. Whereas nuclear power just, you know, it was always seen as having that potential, but it's just not how it's turned out. There are many jurisdictions in the world where nuclear power is not illegal, and in fact, in many places where it's supported by government subsidies as well. And it's just struggling, you know. It's really, really struggling. So people have like a sort of, you know, its advocates often have an unfairly utopic view of its deployment. And of course, the other thing that's worth mentioning on nuclear power is learning the lessons from how it was built and deployed. You know, a lot of those facilities were built. The communities around uranium mines and around nuclear power stations oppose those developments, and the corporations in charge of them were just like, no, screw you, we're just going to do it anyway, because they knew that they had the power to do it. And of course, the lesson is that precisely the same phenomenon can happen with renewables, right? Like, you could have companies building wind farms and solar farms and just being like, no, screw you, we're not going to engage with the community, you're not going to get a share of the benefits. And it can be a really negative thing. And of course, my biggest fear is wind and solar just becoming like nuclear power, right? Like, where you just sort of have this like industrial rot, and the companies in charge are just making awful decisions, and plants are shutting down, and, you know, you're just left with a bunch of bitter sort of aging dudes like, you know, me in my 60s going like, your renewables could have, you know, been powering the whole grid, and, you know, everyone, like, I blame these particular people, and I don't want to end up like that. You know? Yeah, exactly. I don't want to end up bitter sort of and twisted in the same way that, you know, other older technologies, like, they've kind of ended up bitter and twisted today. So I want to avoid that future for wind and solar. And I think doing that involves really thinking a lot more closely about energy justice and you know, fairness and equity and ownership for all these things. Because, I think we can avoid it. I think we can do a good job. I'm optimistic.
Yes, that's good.
I mean, I'm really worried mainly about the perception of nuclear from wrong sources, like Nationals leader David Littleproud, who told Sky News.
We did extensive polling about 2 years ago on this and understood that it wasn't as popular because, in fact, people were getting their information from what they saw on Chernobyl and Fukushima, but also The Simpsons.
So Chernobyl and Fukushima, again, two horrible incidents that involve, which are probably pretty good examples to cite when we're talking about putting a nuclear power plant, but also the cartoon that everyone watched with that big idiot Homer Simpson pressing the wrong button and stuff.
Nuclear. It's pronounced nuclear.
There's a really fascinating, I just highly recommend your listeners look this up. Last week, there was an attempt to introduce a public power plan in New York, and it was shot down by a combination of the fossil fuel lobby, of course, but also private utility-scale solar developers who did not want more public ownership of renewables in New York, which I was really shocked and saddened to see. But, you know, just another example of how power dynamics are going to start manifesting in surprising ways in this issue, because, you know, it's not the 2010s anymore. Things are kind of a bit more developed and they're changing a bit, and we're starting to see, you know, like maybe I'm just very tired, but like it's just like I see it in my head as like, you know, when you see like that footage of like a cell like dividing into different little, you know, it's sort of like you got one cell and it kind of pops into two and then pops into four and then like things like that. I think that we're seeing climate solutions starting to pop into different little political and ideological divides as well.
Yes.
So now you've got like publicly owned renewables side and you've got like privately owned renewables and then you've got like publicly owned nuclear advocates and privately owned nuclear advocates and like the same for like, you know, fossil fuels. And it's really, yeah, there's a lot of little sub fights going on that are actually quite interesting. And I highly recommend if you want to get into these little nitty gritty details, particularly around like American energy technologies. I'm a bit obsessed with America at the moment. All of these fights will probably be coming to Australia at some point. At least I hope so, because they're actually probably important debates to have. You mentioned public ownership a lot, and there are some interesting ways it's manifesting in Australia as well. Like you get like community-owned renewable projects, or you have like state-owned renewables, like in Queensland. So watch this space. But it's that's kind of how I think about nuclear power is in the context of all these other issues. Are you going to Scarborough Fair?
All right, we got to wrap it up. Thank you so much, Ketan. It's been an absolute joy having you here with your good humor and depressing insight into the reality of the climate crisis as it continues. We have a call to action every week. I think it's worth shouting out the Say No to Scarborough campaign feels relevant to what we were talking about. The Scarborough gas project, Woodside Energy's gas project, is insane. It's $16 billion. It's going to emit 1.6 billion tons of carbon over the next 25 years. It has been backed in by the WA Labor government and the federal government as well. As we discussed, they care about the science, but are also backing these massive projects. The Say No campaign is a coalition of 350.org, Greenpeace, Market Forces, the Conservation Council of WA, and the Australian Marine Conservation Society. The project is terrible because it's going to like the building of it will actually fuck over the local marine life. There is some really, really important cultural First Nations sites that has, yeah, extraordinary cultural heritage in that area. It's going to fuck that over and then also blow the carbon budget. So it's so bad on so many various ways. If you're in WA, if you're anywhere, I think like this is the next big fight. This is way bigger than Adani in terms of the carbon impact. This project cannot go ahead. SayNoToScarborough.com.au is the website to go to if you want to find out more about that project and that campaign.
Can I just second that very strongly?
Please, yes.
Like it's such a wild project. And, you know,
it's crazy.
If you were to just imagine how you would feel if somebody just like rocked up and said, we're going to build 10 new coal-fired power stations. Take that feeling and apply it to this project, because this project is worse. And so, yeah, I strongly, strongly recommend that you support that campaign. It's a really bad project.
Do it. Follow Ketan on Twitter. Go to ketanjoshi.co to find out more, to read that upcoming blog post and everything else that he writes. Thanks so much for being on Serious Danger, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed talking about all these issues. I had a blast. So, thanks.
Thanks for staying up late and pulling yourself away from baby duties. If you like the show, you can rate and review on Apple Podcasts, give us a 5-star review or wherever you're listening now. Follow us on social media at Serious Danger AU on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. If you're listening to this on the day it comes out, the Greens National Conference is on. We're doing a live show there today where this comes out. That's going to be great. We'll share that with you in the coming weeks too. And another Patreon ep on the way as well. Thanks for listening, everybody. Bye.
Serious Danger, Australia.